of the Stack Pack, perhaps you can help solve a mystery. Hello, welcome. Hello, welcome, friends, to the Stack Pack. I already said that. David Howell, as always, joined by the lovely Rodan in Commerce City, right? Colorado?
Well, that's where the show's at. I'm actually in Denver.
Oh, so how long does it take for you to get to the venue?
It's a 25-minute drive.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of different little cities in that Denver metro area.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about some true crime. There's a lot of shit. I've been saying this in the past three episodes, yeah. But there's a lot of stuff to get into. This first one is a lot to unpack. It's an unexplained death of Danny Casolaro. 12:30 p.m. on August 10th, 1991. He's found dead by a hotel housekeeper near Martinsburg, West Virginia. Maid finds him in the bathtub, wrist slashed, like, a lot, like, overkill. And the police were called to, you know, figure out what's going on. But they immediately ruled a suicide. There's a note there that says, "To my loved ones, please forgive me, most especially my son, and be understanding. God will let me in." Whatever that means. I don't know. It seems like it's a pretty generic suicide note, right? Like,
yeah.
It's short and it checks some boxes and it's very general and yeah. So in the bathtub, they find razor blade and it's determined that his wrists were slashed a total of 12 times, which is quite a lot. 8 cuts on his left arm and 4 on his right. And one of these cuts was deep enough to sever a tendon. And, yeah, so the investigators find his wallet. All of his credit cards and money are intact. Everything's in the room. No signs of a struggle or someone breaking in or anything like that. And because of that, yeah, they just, you know, wipe their hands of it. Just called it a suicide. That's it. But, you know, it's unsolved mystery, so.
Here's the spin.
Yeah, the details start to get real shady here. They didn't tell the family for a couple days, which is really fucking weird. And the family is just convinced that, you know, he was murdered because of what he was working on, what his job was. He's an investigative journalist. His brother Tony contacts the police and
he's like, "I'm calling you're calling me on Tuesday and this happened on Saturday."
Yeah. And also he was like, "Well, what about all of his research and his papers and all the stuff he had on him? He was going there for to meet with somebody." And the cops said that there was nothing like that at the scene. Just stuff that made it look like he killed himself. And these papers that he had with him apparently was like hundreds of notes and documents from his investigation that he was, you know, a part of for like a year. He was trying to figure out what was going on here. And none of that stuff's ever been recovered. The family also finds it hard to believe that he would slit his own wrist, considering that he was squeamish of things like needles and just general blood tests. So that just didn't seem like, if he was going to commit suicide, it doesn't seem like the way he would do it. And of course, now we start talking about what he was investigating. His friends, he told a bunch of friends that he was close to, you know, breaking the story, and he was ready, you know, his year worth of work was coming to a head and stuff. So this is where it gets really confusing because, like, he was investigating some computer software theft. And, this soon snowballed into an investigation of, you know, government corruption and, you know, this software theft was implicating people high up in the Justice Department. People believe that he knew way too much about something he shouldn't have known about. But it's weird. At the end of the day, I don't know, the way I understood it is just like these people build software that's supposed to help police and then they sell it to a bunch of other like police organizations and then they don't pay the people for it. Is that what happened?
Correct.
Well, it's like,
yep.
Why were people getting shot and killed and just not like, hey, just pay these people their money? Like, they built the software. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something, but it's really fucking weird.
I just kind of very briefly dove into it. And basically, the software called Promise was stolen by someone with the NSA and then secretly put on foreign computers in foreign countries to like gather data from offices and transmit it over electrical wires.
And, so they were using it to steal information
from other countries and other people.
Weird. So they were like, here, use this, like, some European police agency or something, and then they have skim the information, info. Too?
Yeah.
Huh, okay. Well, I mean, that makes a little more sense.
So, like, he was investigating this because it was kind of, you know, this small mom-and-pop software company got pushed out of business by the government while their software was being stolen by the government.
And pretty much the Bill and Nancy Hamilton, the owners of InSlaw, which is the company that made Promise, they talk about how they met with Mr. Coscalero. And, you know, and they give us a little info on what he was investigating. And we pretty much summed it up. Like, they go into it hard. And, you know, they talk about three-year contracts. And, you know, they get into some more specifics. But that's the gist of it, right? Like, we're talking about a murder. The people that own InSlaw figure out that the Canadian government has Promise, and even though they didn't get paid for it, and that kind of starts everything going. They even talked to a guy who got arrested for speaking out on it, right? And they were talking to him from jail. It's really weird.
Yeah, like after he brought questions to light, he magically got arrested for drug charges in Dallas or Houston.
And he probably did have some drugs on him, too. He didn't look very innocent, but who knows. So in August 89, the whole scandal with InSlaw becomes known to Congress and the House Judiciary Committee, and they open up a formal inquest and look into all this stuff. So what they say is as soon as he testified, they arrested him for drugs, like, within that same week.
Yes.
So that's pretty shady. So Danny basically discovers an unsavory network of U.S. officials and organized crime members, and he calls this group the Octopus. I think he liked Marvel Comics.
Oh, yeah. Hell Hydra.
Sounds like some Hydra shit. Is the Hydra symbol an octopus? No.
It is an octopus.
Or a Hydra. No, a Hydra is like a – isn't a Hydra like a
– It's an octopus.
It's like a, but isn't it like a sea creature, like a mythical sea creature? Like it's like huge, a hydra? I don't know.
It's like supposed to be some huge-ass octopus?
I thought that was a squid. I don't know.
Think?
Giant squid. It's a skull with eight legs. Okay, that's what the hydra symbol is. So Danny thought that this octopus, as he called it, was behind several scandals of the 80s, including the Iran-Contra scandal, and the BCCI scandal, and the BNL affair, which I don't know what any of those letters mean, and something called the October Surprise that was apparently discredited. It sounds like a shit you get after having too much pumpkin spice latte. That's pretty good. So, yeah, he blames the octopus for a lot of the, you know, pulling of the strings in the, you know, in the 1980s, political-wise. A week before Danny's death, he tells Tony, his brother, that he's started to receive death threats for looking into this stuff. And he was like, he says in the reenactment, if I die, you shouldn't believe it's an accident. And I do want to say the guy playing Danny is pretty damn good as far as Unsolved Mysteries actors goes. He's definitely shining. He's better than all the people around him in the scenes. August 8th, 91. This is when he arrives in Martinsburg, which will be the last place he'll ever arrive to. And he plans to meet with these informants and, you know, wrap up his investigation. So this new contact was supposed to give him some evidence because he was trying to track the finances of the quote octopus. he was trying to get stuff like IRS printouts on these certain shady individuals. The day right before his death, he met up with a guy named William Turner, Orlando Bloom's character from the Pirates of the Caribbean films. I think William Turner. So William Turner was a former employee of the defense contractor, and he gave him some paperwork that described corruption. And this was the corruption that Danny believed was tied to the octopus. Next day, Danny's dead, and none of these documents are there. So that's kind of it's a contrived kind of wild little story, but. So after all this, and after the brothers all pissed off, he tries to get an inquest to get a complete autopsy done. And then they figure out this fool's already embalmed. And they were like, is that normal that the family doesn't say to do this? And they just do it anyway. And they're like, nope, not normal. Government, I don't know. It's really shady, this fucking story.
Oh, it's about to get crazier, man.
The autopsy confirms that the bleeding from his wrists were the cause of his death. Okay, great. We knew that. But it also suggested that he wasn't alone at the time, because there was a bruise on his arm and head. And also the tips of three of his fingernails were missing. The tips, which is really weird. Like, he grabbed something hard.
Like he broke his nails.
And that's not something you do while you're just, slashing your wrist 12 times, which seems like a lot. I don't know.
Seems a bit excessive, yeah.
The family also learns that his hotel room was, like, professionally cleaned the very next day, and they were just throwing away evidence, like bloody rags and stuff. And one of the people cleaning remembered seeing two bloody towels in the bathroom. So it looked like that one of the cops had been trying to clean blood off the floor themselves before they hired the professional crew to come in. This is fucking weird. We need to talk about the mysterious man at Danny's funeral. There's a tall, kind of stoic, older black man who's highly decorated with military garb, medals and stuff. He was definitely a high-up official. And he placed a medal on the casket and kind of, like, somber, very in a very somber way, like, paid his respects. And, nobody knew who he was. Like, they asked at the party after, and they asked everybody at the funeral, and nobody knew who he was. So, of course, it goes without saying, the family believes that the whole Ensla investigation had something to do with his death. Several people believe. Yeah, and here's where the tin hat stuff start, because who knows, right? But a lot of people do think that Danny was murdered by the secret clandestine government agency dubbed the Octopus. But such presence is unconfirmed at best. I love the wording. Who writes the fucking wikis? It's
all not right. Bad. So, how I mentioned earlier that, the Promise software was fraudulently stolen and then sold to various countries? The suspected fraudster, who could also be very much the money to Octopus, is none other alleged Israeli spy Robert Maxwell, who is the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's associate.
Yeah. And her name is not Ghislaine. It's Ghislaine. It's just spelt insane. Ghislaine Maxwell. Ghislaine. I mean, shit. Ugh. The amount of billionaire awful jizz she's probably seen in her life. So her dad was an Israeli spy?
Allegedly. And apparently he's linked up into this whole Promise software scandal of the 1980s.
Interesting. Is he still alive?
No, he mysteriously died on a yacht that was later owned by... Actually, I think Jeffrey Epstein ended up buying it.
What? So she was just, like, chilling on the yacht that her father was mysteriously killed on?
I think so. I don't remember the full story. Like, I'm looking it up.
What the fuck? That lady. That's weird. I didn't know. I thought she was just like some like kind of secretary, you know, business assistant who just got wrapped up in all this crazy shit. I didn't know that she like her dad was a shady possible spy. Well, I mean, shady, I don't know. Israeli spy, I don't know. Who knows what that means? But yeah, selling software to clandestine governments. That's pretty weird.
Yeah, apparently he was on his yacht called Lady Ghislaine, trying to see who bought it after his death.
Wait, so he named the yacht after his daughter?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about this Lost Loves real quick. Or is there any other crazy thing you got you want to say? You're making a weird face.
No. No, I was just trying not to burp into the mic.
Well. So let's talk about Mr. Bill O'Neill, who has spent much of his adult life looking for his birth father, Jim Burke. When he was a child, he felt like he was different and he didn't look like his, exactly like his six brothers and sisters. He was told that his father was Paul O'Neill and that he died shortly before his birth. So years pass and all these kids grow up and they have families of their own. And Bill's older brother, Tim, is visiting the father's grave in Chicago. And then he sees the death date, and the death date makes no sense. Because if he was actually born, if he died on December 20th, 1958, as the stone said, it would have made it impossible for him to be one of for Bill to be one of his kids. So, but Bill had to keep this to himself for years because his mom didn't want him to tell him and said she'd take it to her grave. The fact that Bill had been born 2 years after his father's death. But Tim eventually tells Bill, and, you know, Bill had already had a feeling, right? Like ever since he was a kid, you know, he's like, I have darker eyes and slightly different.
The whole reenactment was weird. I'm not asking mom, I'm asking you.
Yeah. I don't know. The acting wasn't bad, but it's just, it was awkward. And it was just like, where do they live? Like his room was very messy. It just looked like, it looked freaking, I don't know.
Like a teenager's
yeah,
room?
Yeah, it did. Like the mattress was on the floor. So Bill, you know, his brother tells him the truth and then you know, he confronts his mom and his mom's like, she tells him about how she met Paul in 1953. They were married the next year. Over the next 4 years, they had the three children. Then Paul goes to World War II. Paul was a World War II veteran, and he had chronic kidney ailment. So he was sick. And in November of 58, she visits Paul at the Veterans Hospital. And one of these times when she visits him, she meets Jim Burke, who's a friend of Paul's. And sadly, Paul passes away that same year. And soon after, Jim and Lynn began dating. And summer of 59, they all moved to California together, right? I don't know if they lived together, if they just kept dating and she just went with her family, you know, to, I don't know. They're never that clear. But a year later, Bill's born. And then the next year, Lynn's pregnant again. But by the time this baby's born, Jim's nowhere. He's peaced out. They didn't have a great relationship, I guess. And this is just what sucks about like you could be like, oh, this mom made mistakes and she shouldn't have done this. She shouldn't have done that. But it's just like, damn, dude, like she had these kids and then this guy dies and then she has more kids with this other guy. And then this guy just fucking leaves her. She's like, damn, I have too many kids. I have fucking six kids. This is insane. And she started having, and the baby.
Medical issues.
The baby.
Or was it the baby that had medical issues?
The baby Peggy, the youngest daughter, started having medical problems and Lynn decides to give her up for adoption, but she tells the children, she's not even honest to the children. She tells them that she's going to a hospital. And then she later claimed that Peggy had died. I guess that was easier for her. I don't know. This lady seems like she
Damn.
Trying to make up for her mistakes, but I don't
know. That's like my mom telling me my goldfish went to the goldfish farm when I was like six.
Right. Except for it's a human child. It's way fucking worse than your goldfish, Dan. I think I had a goldfish. I remember winning a goldfish somewhere, like you do, as a kid.
Maybe at a school fair.
Yeah, something like that. In 1990, Lynn tells her children that Peggy isn't dead and that Peggy's contacted her and wants to meet with her brothers and sisters. And, like, Bill's a nice guy, man. He doesn't. He feels no animosity towards his mom and anything. He's just like, wow, cool. Like, I really want to meet her, you know? Like, he gets it. Like, this is a different time. Lots of hard decisions. So Peggy was apparently adopted by the Coleman family in Sillin, California. She was renamed Karen. And, he wanted to contact the parents and kind of ask them about her. And then Karen answered the phone herself. And she's like, hey, I'm your sister. And they reunited, I guess. And they're adorable. they're really sweet. I will say that. I don't usually like these lost loves. But, yeah, they seem like they really love each other. And now they're...
Yeah, I mean, we're actually covering a lost love.
Yeah. So basically, they're looking for their dad. And they never find him. But they do find, the night of the broadcast, Eileen Esler and new... Eileen Esler of New Lexon, Illinois, calls the telecenter and says that she's one of Jim Burke's four children. And she also informs them that Jim passed away in 1988, but they're also overjoyed to learn that they have siblings. So they all meet up and it's really cute. The Bill says he's sitting next to his sister and he's like, well, you know, when they were coming, I didn't know that I would have like an immediate physical, like, love for them right away, and when I saw them it was just immediate. And then the daughters the sisters like ditto, and they're cute. I like this story, and maybe it's better that they didn't meet their dad. You know, I don't know, maybe he wasn't that good. He wouldn't have given them any good answers, you know. I don't know. I think it's nice that all the siblings got back together, and they just I like to think that they had a nice Zoom Thanksgiving meal just last year. All right, we got a couple more cases, and we're going to be talking about a really, really tragic fucking case right now. Next, this is the Blind River Killer, so we're going to be talking about. All right, so Gord McAllister tells us the story of June 27th, 1991. Him and his wife, Jackie, his wife of 39 years, Jackie, who was 59 years old, and he was 62. They stop at a rest stop in Blind River, Ontario, in their sweet camper to spend the night. So around 12:55 a.m., on June 28th, a dude claiming to be a police officer knocks on their door and tells them they have to move their RV. And this is highly unusual, but Jackie opens the door like nothing. And the man comes in with two guns. It was a rifle and a shotgun, just like two huge guns, like pointing it at them, telling them to give them their money and stuff. And he says, I'm going to rob you and then I'm going to kill you. That's what he says in the reenactment. It's super scary. So she puts rings and jewelry and money and all the purse and all the stuff in her purse in there. And then for no reason, you know, he just kills her. The husband Gord is able to like kind of jump at him and, you know, move him, you know, like throw him off balance a little bit so he can get out of the RV. And he immediately like slides under the RV as the dude fires the gun at him, like through the door. And even more tragically, at the same time, a guy named Brian Major, who's a 29-year-old father, he arrived at the rest stop and he asked this, you know, he asked the man if he needed any help. And then when he noticed the guy had guns, he tries to get back in his car. And then, well, in the reenactment, the guy gets right in front of his car and shoots him right there through the car window. And then the gunman gets into what we assume is a van and drives off. Gord runs out to the highway, realizing that he's been shot too, to get help. But Jackie, his wife, and Brian, the, you know, the would-be do-gooder, are dead. Gord does survive, even though, you know, he did get, like, grazed, I believe. I don't know. It's hard to say. They make a composite of the gunman, and the cops, you know, they start trying to figure out what happened. A witness comes forward claiming that the gunman pulled out of the rest stop in a blue van and nearly hit them, like, going the wrong way on the road. And then he continued east towards Sudbury, Ontario. The witness didn't know what the license plate said or anything like that. And, you know, I think it said that they looked for over, like, they had a crazy number of blue vans that they looked at and couldn't find anything. Then we get some cool high-tech shit. Gord helps the cops make a computer composite of the gunman. And they do this very scene in, I think, For Your Eyes Only, the James Bond movie. They say this is like some cool technology. For Your Eyes Only, 1983. 10 years before this. They did a more convincing version of it in a Roger Moore James Bond movie. Like, I'm not even talking about a good one. I mean, Roger Moore is my favorite James Bond. And I know he's not in the best movies and that he's technically not the best James Bond, but he's my favorite because he's funny and charming. And just the most British James Bond, hands down. But yeah, it's some For Your Eyes Only shit. They leave this as unsolved on the episode of Unsolved Mysteries, but it's pretty much solved, I would say. In 1999, a guy named Ronald West was identified by the police. At the time, he was currently serving prison for two unrelated murders in 1970. And a couple of home invasion robberies. And I looked up and I looked into these murders in 1970 and they were both like young housewives. And I think they both had the same job. Like they were both teachers or nurses or something weird like that. They didn't know each other, but, yeah, they were both murdered and raped in their homes. And they believe that he was, the Blind River killer. He's never been charged. He's in jail for life. Real piece of shit either way. He's going to rot forever. But, they think it's him. And the reason they think it's him is because of circumstantial evidence, which is what they call it. At the time of the murders, he lived 12 miles away from the crime scene. He also owned a 22 caliber rifle and he had a 20 gauge shotgun, which is the same two guns that this dude was like holding at the same time. And the weapons he used to commit the murder of Jackie and Brian, I think was the man's name.
His ex-wife also noted that he owned a mid-80s blue van that matched the same description.
How did they miss a fucking van that somebody owned 12 miles away? It's, you know, I don't know. And she says that the composite actually looks like him if he wore a blonde wig, which is weird, but... I don't know. I get people do that a lot. Like if you have one weird thing about you, people won't really notice anything else. Like he had like kind of stringy, weird blonde hair, you know? So maybe that was smart. Maybe he just like literally took his girlfriend's wig. Oh yeah. And actually, and interestingly enough, this guy, Ronald West was an ex-police officer. And that would actually line up with the gunman saying that he was a police officer. Shittily, Gordy dies in 2012. And he never gets the true answer to Jackie's murder. But by that time in 2012, I think that's bullshit. I think he knows who killed Jackie. And he knows that fucker's in jail. And that guy was a pretty old 62 in 1993. He lived about 20 more years. I mean, I guess he still would have only been 82. He just looked pretty old. That was a pretty old 62. Like, I was watching an interview with Michael Keaton because he's the greatest Batman and just a great man. And he was just so, like, animated and great. And I was like, how old is he? He's got to be fucking old. And this guy was 69. Michael Keaton is 69, and he seems way more young and youthful than 62-year-old Gord. But also, Gord is heartbreaking in this, so it's hard. I don't want to be mean to him. Like, him telling his story is so fucking sad. And the way he just literally says over and over that he just doesn't want to live, it's like, guys, cut that out. Fuck. Shit's dark. Like, he's just like, I don't even care. It's so fucking sad. Poor Gord. But yeah, Gord, I say that I call bullshit on Unsolved Wiki. I think he knows exactly who killed his wife, and he was happy to know that the man would be in jail for the rest of his shitty life. I think Gord had some peace in that way. But yeah, really sad story. Ronald Glenn West, I think. I know he has a middle name, but it doesn't say it on here.
Yeah, I think it's Ronald Glenn West.
Yeah. So, fuck that guy. This story just pisses me off. This is just one of those stories. This last story is just one of those lazy-ass police work fucking bullshit. Brendan Dassey motherfucking bullshit. Do you remember who Brendan Dassey is? No. The guy.
Yeah.
The nephew who's in jail with his uncle because he was kind of mentally mentally challenged or educationally challenged, and the cops just like, he just wanted to go home and watch.
Took advantage of that.
He just wanted to go home and watch fucking wrestling. So he was like, yeah, sure. I helped my uncle rape someone. I don't know what, like, I just want to go wrestling. And he's in jail, and yeah, it's bullshit, but this is a very similar story. It's a very frustrating story, but it does have a happy ending, sort of. These stories are always so, like, bittersweet. Like, we had one just last week, too. Like, when someone's wrongly accused and you're like, oh, 9 years in prison! And they finally got out! And it's like, fucking 9 years! Like, fuck them! Like, fuck the, like, whoever fucking dropped that ball. It's so annoying. But anyway.
Yeah, that time's not replaceable. You can't, like, give that back.
Yeah, especially when you're, like, in the prime of your life, like, what was his name? The guy from the last episode. I guess you weren't on the last episode, but there was a guy who, this black guy was in jail, for robbing a Arby's and shooting a police officer. And he was there with his friends right before the robbery. He's like, why would I go in, eat food? He kind of even made a scene.
Like, why would I be a paying customer and immediately rob the
immediately
place?
Immediately leave,
like,
and then come back and rob the place, yeah. And so after like 8.5 years, but this guy had a great sense of humor, and he was really, like, his lawyer was like, this man is one of the best people I've ever met. He's a great person. it was a nice story, but it's just like, fuck. Like, that was a young man who didn't need to spend 9 years in jail. Yeah. But anyway, let's talk about this case. November 8th, 1983, 38-year-old divorcee Susan Hamwee is found murdered in her Fort Lauderdale home. A friend called the cops to go check on her because she hadn't been, heard from in a couple days. And she was sexually molested, is the way they say it. And she was strangled with a telephone cord and stabbed to death with a carving knife. This is ugly. Also, her 18-month-old daughter, Shane, died of neglect, technically, because, that's such a small baby. And when Susan was died and just like several days of being alone, yeah, the baby, technically the baby dehydrated. So fucking sad. The two pieces of evidence that they had to go on was the bloody carving knife and red human hair. So, that's what leads to the next thing here. The next day after the murder, they question Susan's 66-year-old neighbor, Emma, and her 42-year-old son, John Purvis. John had red hair, so the police are a little interested in him, him being the neighbor. So they had him come down to the police station, and his mom came with him. John was schizophrenic. Did I say that? No, I didn't say that, huh?
Yeah. Oh, no, but they do say it in the episode.
Yeah. John was schizophrenic, and the cops didn't know this when they talked to him. They didn't know that he had any, you know, mental issues or anything of that nature. They really went after him. They questioned him, and Emma came into the room yelling, had them stop the interrogation. But the cops were very determined to talk to him, and later they get a psychiatrist to give him a personality test using what they call TAT cards. Apparently they have like ambiguous drawings and they're supposed to require interpretation. Like, what does this mean to you kind of thing? And they never explain, but one of these cards gets him acting really weird and he just panics and says, well, I have to go to jail or can I go to a hospital? And that they thought that was weird, but it's like, you know, you're stressing out this man.
One of the cards is probably a crime scene photo.
That seems like it'd be fucked up, but yeah, cops are kind of fucked up. He also kept asking the cops during this thing, or the people during this thing, if they think he did it. He eventually does confess to killing her for refusing his sexual advances, but he also confessed to the police officers.
Well, he says he does it because they told him that if he confessed that he could go home.
Yeah, which is bullshit. Like, the same thing they did with Brendan Dassey. Like, if a cop ever tells you, if you confess, you can go home, first of all, it doesn't make any sense. Like, only somebody with a, you know, a dampened mental capacity would take that logic and run. So it's just like, I don't know. How could you live with yourself, you know, have, you know, convincing someone to do that? Like, if someone's going to do that, they're obviously, you know, they are not all there, you know. So, yeah, it's predatory. Just like, oh, we don't want to fucking work any harder. Like, this guy's got red hair and he's the neighbor. Fine. So they arrest John. They charge him with the murders. At the trial, only the confession is allowed into evidence. They don't take anything else into consideration. They don't take into consideration that the red hairs didn't match John. They don't take into consideration that the way he says he killed her after like being hounded by the cops doesn't match the crime scene at all. They just throw him into jail. Give him life in prison. And apparently his lawyers reached out to Unsolved Mysteries because they he got new lawyers in 87. And they contacted the guys, the show, and wanted to know if they would profile the case. And sure enough, it really did help. This was the linchpin. This is what helped. After Unsolved Mysteries, police reopened the investigation. I wonder if it's because of like people and the town got mad, or if the cops were just like, well, we better look at this again. So after this, they quickly focus in on Paul Hamley, who was a wealthy real estate developer in Aspen, Colorado. And literally, he was Susan's ex-husband. Isn't this the first person they should have looked at?
Yeah.
At the time of the murder, he was in Aspen recovering from a broken leg. But that doesn't mean shit, does it? Summer of 92, police followed up on a tip that they had received back in 1985, which is fucking annoying that they got a tip like this in 1985. The info led the police to a guy named Robert Beckett. Beckett said that he was dying and he agreed to tell the police everything that happened in exchange for immunity. You know, he just wanted to like die in peace and get this shit off his chest. He claims that he and an accomplice named Paul Surio had been paid $14,000 to murder Susan. And of course, motive being avoiding the $180 he owed her for back alimony and things like that. So
$180,000.
I said 180.
Just yeah. God damn. I was like, damn, $14,000 for 180.
Fucking murder someone for $180. yeah. So yeah, $180,000. Sorry. That's what she was owed in alimony. So Beckett claimed that he and Serio traveled to Florida on August 31st of 1983, as the very day that Halloween 3 season of The Witch came out. Just kidding. I don't know. I think it was the year before, actually. The next day they go to Susan's home and she actually just lets Beckett into the house because they had actually met before. I don't know how they had met before. It's really weird. But once inside, he attacks Susan and kills her. And he says that he makes it look like a sex crime slash robbery. So that's very interesting to me. Like, after all said and done, he's like, not going to admit that he raped her. He's like, we made it look like that. So while they were, while they were investigating this after the fact in the 90s, the cops started recording conversations between Beckett and Serio where they talked about the murder in detail. The murders, it is two murders. They also recorded conversations between Beckett and Hamley. So he like reached out to this guy, to Paul. And in January of 93, the Pauls, Hamley and Serio, are arrested and charged with the murders. So I guess Beckett did get his immunity, even though he was involved in the death of a young woman and her baby. So fuck him. And also,
Don't worry. There's an update for him.
Before we get to that, also fuck Paul, dude. Like, kill my wife and like doesn't give a fuck about his baby. The baby might not have been his, but I don't know. But fuck, that's so ugly. The Pauls are charged with the murders. After serving 10 years for the murders, John Purvis was finally released. 10 fucking years. And he was completely exonerated at a formal hearing in February of 93. And he got to go back home with his mother. Serio and Hamley were both convicted and sentenced to life. Serio died in 2004. And Beckett, do you know anything more about this, or just what the Wikipedia said?
No, just, you know, his immunity was short-lived because he was later convicted for an unrelated murder.
So he wasn't dying? You think he lied about the dying thing?
Maybe was like, you know, I'll just lie about dying and then confess, get like a free pass, go, don't go to jail type card.
Do you think he did this murder?
Probably like around the same time, maybe. And just like hoped like it would get swept under the rug.
Do you think he did this murder? Do you think he did this murder after the fact? Like after all the fucking shit? Like after he got away with killing Hamley, the lady?
I don't know.
That's crazy. Yeah, like these people don't, you can't change. I started listening to last podcast has a really good, they're starting a little three-part series on Billy the Kid. And I like Billy the Kid a lot more than I thought I did. I was like, whenever I think of Old West guys, I'm like, like as cool as like Gunslinger seems, like they were all just pieces of shit. And Billy the Kid kind of wasn't. He was like a really likable, like scruffy, really smart, like kind of entertainer, like a showboat, like a ham, you know? Oh yeah, Murder Tapes was the show we mentioned last time. We were like, murder something? Fucking Murder Tapes, duh.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Oh, on Showtime, there's a really well done UFO series. It's a documentary series produced by J.J. Abrams, and it just kind of, you know, it's a very cool look at some famous UFO. I've only seen the first episode where they really get into the Phoenix Lights, which is really fucking interesting because that was just seen by so many people, and it's similar to Roswell in that, like, what the government officially said what it was just like, nobody's buying that, dude. And it's so cool because it's so recent, 1997. I think I've talked on the show about how Kurt Russell reported it. He was flying his son down to Phoenix to meet his girlfriend or something in the 90s, and he reported the lights to air traffic control. Isn't that badass? Kurt Russell, sci-fi action star, saw some UFOs and reported it. I love that story. But yeah, it's just called UFO, and it's on Showtime right now, and that's pretty cool. I haven't really been watching much true crimey stuff. I've been kind of keeping it, watching a lot of comedy lately, actually. Ghosts on BBC is a delight. Yeah, that's fun. Wellington Paranormal is also good. Yeah, spooky but funny is some. If you got HBO Max, Wellington Paranormal, which is a spinoff of What We Do in the Shadows. It's about New Zealand cops who deal with paranormal things. Oh, it's
brilliant.
It's so dry, so fun. And Ghosts is a really cute show about this couple that inherits a mansion, and the wife can see all the ghosts. The husband can't, but he just kind of you know, goes with it and believes his wife. And all the ghosts are from very different time periods, and that's where the comedy really, you know, simmers.
Lies.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's like a caveman and a Victorian woman and like a kind of colonial era poet, and it's cute, it's great. And there's also a politician who died in some sort of scandal without his pants, so he just like he's like in a 90s business suit and no pants. Like, that's just how he always looks. There's also a Boy Scout headmaster who has an arrow through his neck. It's good. I recommend it. Damn, also fucking Sweet Tooth, man. I don't know why I was sitting on Sweet Tooth so long. I think it's just because it's one of those shows they spent so much money on, and I didn't want to invest in it if they're not going to keep going, you know, for a couple of years. But I threw on an episode. My mom was over last night. I made some dinner for her. And my God, it's like Walking Dead meets Harry Potter or like apocalyptic Stranger Things. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but it's so fucking cool. It's like a very adult fairy tale is the best way to explain it. I don't want to say Walking Dead because even though it's one of the most popular shows in the world, they never really gave them any money for good CGI effects or fucking.
Are we going to talk about the deer scandal again?
Talk about the deer, yeah. I mean, God bless Greg Nicotero, and the real effects, the zombie effects, were always really top notch, but I mean, yeah. It's like you think they would give him some more fucking money, you know, it being the most popular show. The last season starting, Rick's coming back. God, I haven't watched that show in years. I'd rather catch up on The Flash. Even though that show's just like, I think Cisco's leaving now. I'm like, get the fuck out of here.
No,
I don't want to see any of that. Well, he should leave. That guy should have been in like In the Heights or something. Like, I feel like that CW contract, because he's like a Broadway guy. He's like a singer. Like, I really like that actor, Carlos Valdez. He could forever just make money at conventions from now on. But he needs to go on and, you know, do some theater, do some cool work. Because, you know, when you're on The Flash, you're just That's a 7-year contract where you're doing nothing but hanging out in Canada, telling Barry to run fast. Run, Barry, run! The first couple of seasons of that show are pretty fun, though. But yeah, that's all I got. You got anything? Were you able to watch anything on the long ride, or you just kind of slept and...
I slept and then stared out the window and enjoyed the view.
Of your bus driver stopping and getting you guys all worried?
Yeah. Well, no. Like, actually, like, when I got up, I just spent like a good hour just staring out the window and just watching the Wyoming hills roll by.
Wyoming.
It was nice.
How long was that drive from Missoula to Denver?
I think it was like 14 hours, 14 and a half. We left at 3 a.m. and we got here at 5:22 p.m.
How fast are the buses allowed to go?
Good question. I think they top out at like 90, but they're usually at about 75 to 80.
Yeah, seems like they'd be going a little slower than that. That's scary. Just want to make sure that you're 65. Safe.
I don't know. They drive. They go pretty fast.
Is your bus cool? All right.
It's all right. It's older, but it's reliable.
That's cool. Dude, that one, I'll never forget that tour bus in England, the double-decker tour bus. Like, you had to kind of bend over.
Beat the streets.
Yeah, you had to kind of bend down, but it was so fucking cool. The top just looked like it was so rock star. Like, the glass counters. We were talking about how it's just, like, made for, like, massive mountains of cocaine. That was fun. And Kevin. That was Kevin Hart, right? Or was that Muse?
I think both.
Well,
definitely Muse.
It was the one where I rode with you guys.
Muse.
That was cool. I rode with you guys to Birmingham. Or was it back to England from Birmingham?
It was back to England.
Back to London from Birmingham. It's all England.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is all England.
Yeah, cool double-decker tour
buses. That was like 2 years ago.
I know.
So crazy.
One day, hopefully, we'll be back in some fun place, random place together. All right. Thanks, guys, for hanging out with us. This was a lot of fun. We'll be back next week with some form of the lineup. Trying to get all three of us at one time is a little difficult, but no need to worry. There's no feud between Daniel and Eli. I'm just the only one who's never busy. There's bad blood. Let's start the rumor. Yeah, Dan and Eli, they had a falling out.
We haven't spoken in months.
No, we talk all the time. But everyone's just super busy. Eli's got two jobs, and Dan's like literally in a different city every day, every other day. But yeah, we're gonna keep bringing the shit at you, and we'll keep bringing the podcast to you, and and it's gonna go on forever because Peacock has all 12 seasons of the Stack stuff, and then after we can just be the French friends and talk about the Unsolved Mysteries podcast that's killing it. Steve French has got a great voice, so I'd be down to be the French friends. Nobody steal that from us. I can call up a French person.
Trademark that.
Yeah. I feel like I got to call up a French person just once. So technically there's been a French person on the French Friends. All right. I'll let you guys live your lives. Thank you for listening to us. You can support us by listening to the stupid Anchor ads, or you can donate directly at Anchor. And also you can support us by leaving comments on Apple iTunes. Tell your friends, share it. We like doing this, and we want some more people to have fun listening to us. We like our cool little group of, like, I'd say about 500, 600 listeners. It's fun bringing it to you guys either way. Because if all of you guys were in a room together, holy shit. That would be freaky. I think I would, like, I don't know. I think I'd poop my pants if we had to, like, do it live in front of all of our listeners. So I always think of it that way. That's cool. We love you. For every mystery, there's someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone is listening, and perhaps that someone is you.